Move to the third case this morning, Schaefer v. the American Medical Association.
May it please the Court, my name is Jeffrey Tarrant. I represent the plaintiff, William Schaefer. When a decision maker changes his mind regarding which of two employees to downsize just 4 business days after learning that one of them is requesting a 6-week FMLA leave with no other intervening event, that should be enough to raise a tribal issue of fact as to whether the request for medical leave unlawfully motivated the change of mind. And that's the situation that we have in this case. Plus, the presence of 3 types of evidence which this Court has held is sufficient to raise a tribal issue with regard to pretext. The fabrication and backdating of documents by the decision maker about the decision itself, irreconcilably different testimony between the decision maker and his HR rep that he spoke to, and different explanations at different times about why, what motivated the decision. In this case, the district court usurped the role of the jury by resolving factual inferences in favor of the defendant. The facts are fairly simple. In the fall of 2008, the sole decision maker in this case, Michael Lynch, was told he had to reduce the headcount for budgetary reasons by 1. A jury can find that he made that decision on October 28, 2008, deciding to eliminate the position of Peter Friedman and not to eliminate the position of Bill Schaefer. And then he changed his mind 4 business days after being told by Mr. Schaefer that he had to take leave to have a knee replacement, which was going to be in January 12th of 2009, with nothing substantive happening in between. In the record, you'll see the 2008 email from Mr. Lynch, in which he tells his superior, and this was in response to an email asking should he eliminate Mr. Schaefer's position, and he writes, "I know you want closure on this issue tomorrow, so I'll be straightforward. I do not think cutting additional positions beyond Pete's is in my team's, our work, or the AMA's best interest." Mr. Lynch goes on in that email to provide specific reasons why the speech writing department needs the position of Mr. Schaefer. Now, that's on October 28th. The next thing that happens in this case is that on November 20th, just about 3 weeks later, Mr. Schaefer notifies the AMA that he has to take a 4 to 6 week FMLA leave to have knee replacement surgery. And then 4 business days later, exactly 2 years from today, because it was over Thanksgiving weekend, Mr. Lynch has what he terms in an email an 11th hour change of heart. In a Sunday night email, he decides and tells his supervisor that he's now decided that Mr. Friedman is more valuable than Mr. Schaefer. The plaintiff contends there were no intervening events other than the request for medical leave, which caused Mr. Lynch to reverse his decision.
But wasn't there an AMA conference somewhere in the early part of December or something like
there
that?
There was what they call the interim conference on November 8th and 9th. And the defendants have said that that somehow influenced the decision. The problem is that there's contradictory evidence in the record. Mr. Schaefer, and it's an undisputed fact, was told that his performance had absolutely nothing to do with the termination decision. The human resources representative, Mr. Daniels, said that performance had nothing to do with it, and there's not a single document in the record, including the backdated documents that I'll refer to, that make any reference to the November 8th or 9th interim meeting. So it's a highly contested fact whether that played any role whatsoever in the termination decision. The position of the defendant is that the October 28th email was not a decision to eliminate Mr. Friedman's position, that it was somehow an ongoing decision, and that the true decision, he hadn't made up his mind until November 30th. But that's not what the October 28th email suggests. And that's not what the words, an 11th hour change of heart, which were Mr. Lynch's words in his November 30th email, suggests. But even if that was a plausible explanation, it's not for the trial court to make the determination accepting one reasonable inference over another. This court has more recently, in Gelzer versus Sheboygan and Kodish versus Oakbrook, counseled that it's for the jury to determine which inferences should be drawn from the facts, unless the plaintiff's theory is based upon flights of fancy, speculation, hunches, intuition, or rumors. Those are the words in the Kodish case. We would submit that this case is much more like Kasna, where the decision was made on the heels of the protected activity, and in fact, more compelling than Kasna, because we have both direct and indirect evidence that also suggests that the termination decision was motivated by the request for leave. The direct evidence is right in the November 30th email. While it does talk about the change of heart, it also says and offers, we would say, a window into the decision-making here, that the team is already preparing for Bill's short-term leave in January, so his departure should not have any immediate negative effect. The indirect evidence is really in three different kinds of evidence, and I want to focus first on the importance of the backdated evidence documents, especially that of the Human Resources Director, Mr. Daniels. Both of the people who participated in the termination decision, and there was only one decision maker, that's an undisputed fact, that's Mr. Lynch, but both Mr. Lynch and Harvey Daniels, the HR rep, created employment documents months after the fact and backdated those documents to a time in November around the decision to make it look like there were non-discriminatory reasons for the decision. This court's made clear in Brunker versus Schwann that backdating documents to give the impression that an illegal factor did not motivate a termination raises a tribal issue regarding the motive to terminate.
Aren't they both backdated to dates after Mr. Schaefer gave notice of his intent to take leave?
In actuality, but they didn't realize that. Specifically, Mr. Daniels' document is dated November 25th. That date is fairly important because he testified at his deposition that he had two conversations with Mr. Lynch. The first was on November 25th, in which supposedly Lynch told him he's decided to terminate Mr. Schaefer and gives the reasons for that, none of which involve performance. And Daniels testified that Lynch said nothing about Schaefer's leave request and gave him the impression that he didn't know about it. And the next day, November 26th, he has a second conversation with Lynch in which Lynch says, I just found out that Schaefer is requesting leave to have a knee replacement. Does that change or affect the decision in any way? So when, on February 3rd, Mr. Daniels writes a memo and dates it November 25th, supposedly memorializing a conversation, he's doing it under the impression that he's writing down a decision that was made before Lynch knew that there was a leave request. In that respect, it's on all fours with the decision in Brunker where they backdated something to the day before a medical diagnosis.
So then your position is that if Daniels did not know of the November 20th email, that what's possible is that he tried to create a paper trail showing that Lynch decided to eliminate Schaefer before the leave request.
That's absolutely correct. And I think Daniels' testimony itself supports that, and there's nothing in the record that indicates that he knew of the November 20th. With regard to the I should say one other thing about that, which also allows an inference. In the defendant's brief, they talk about the fact that Mr. Daniels met with in-house counsel on February 2nd for the purpose of determining who had custody of documents and to implement a litigation hold. Well, the testimony is that the document, which we only found out about its creation through looking at the metadata after we got it, was created on February 3rd. And that after he created the document on the computer, he took his handwritten notes that he says he made on November 25th, took them to the copy room and put them through the shredder. So I think a jury could consider the fact that what's he doing shredding handwritten documents the day after he meets with counsel, allegedly to implement a litigation hold. Another thing of note of importance with regard to that is that there is a conflict, irreconcilable, between the testimony of Lynch and the testimony of Daniels about whether there ever was a meeting on November 25th. The record is clear. Mr. Lynch doesn't remember meeting on November 25th with Daniels, and it's contradicted by the fact that Lynch has stated, and his email shows, that he did not make the decision to eliminate Schaefer's position until Sunday evening, November 30th. So our position is that's a fabricated document on November 25th. The meeting never took place.
Was there anything in Lynch's calendar to reflect that a meeting took place on that date?
No. In fact, the record is clear, and I think the district court put it in her opinion that the testimony was that there was nothing in the calendar of Lynch or of Daniels indicating that they had a meeting of that day.
I want to ask you quickly about the Lynch memo that was clawed back. The contents of that really just give you additional shifting reasons, right?
That's correct.
You've got what you contend are shifting reasons even before you get that document.
That's absolutely correct. We believe that it's cumulative. It becomes an issue that we intend and would like to use on remand. It's fairly consistent with what Mr. Daniels does, and it contradicts some of the reasons. There's only two reasons in that memo for the termination, and they have nothing to do with the interim meeting. They have nothing to do with Peter Friedman being more valuable. And it shows a pattern of attempting to create documents to give the illusion that there was a non-discriminatory determination.
How was the fact that the court and you or whoever learned that these documents were made up at a time different from when the date was on them?
How was that determined?
Yes.
Okay. The Daniels memo was determined because when we got it and we saw the November 30th memo, we realized that there couldn't have been a meeting on November 25th in which it was decided to terminate Mr. Schaefer, because Mr. Lynch says he didn't make that decision till the 30th. So we asked to look at the original file, computer file, and we went behind and looked at the metadata, and that tells you when the document is created, and that said February 3rd. With regard to the Lynch memo was turned over to us in discovery with no cover letters, no indication that it was privileged, and then we received a phone call from counsel that said, we want the document back. It's privileged. And it was revealed to us that it had not been created on the 21st of November.
Was there any time, other than the fact it's had that those dates on them, that they advanced that it was created on the date?
No. There was other than the fact that the document spoke for itself, and if you've looked at the document, it's addressed to Harvey Daniels. It's dated the 21st. There's nothing on it that indicates that it's a draft or it's for any review. At the bottom, it says to Harvey Daniels, if you have any questions, call me back. When we first got it, we thought it was genuine. But it turned out it's not. And I see I'm into my rebuttal time. But I'll just briefly say then that we have appealed the issue on the attorney-client privilege. We do not think that there's any indicia of attorney-client privilege in that document, and we'll be asking the court to reverse that so that we could use it on remand. And unless there are other questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You don't have much time there, but okay. Whatever you have, you can use. Mr. Ross?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Jeff Ross. I'm the attorney for the appellee, the American Medical Association. Plaintiff's counsel makes a number of arguments to this court, which, as I think we've demonstrated, were waived below because they were never raised. Okay. Some of the arguments that he makes to this court are simply unsupported by the factual record. The first one is his claim that 4 days after Mr. Schaefer gave notice that he needed FMLA leave, the decision was made to terminate him. In fact, Mr. Schaefer's statement of undisputed facts specifically states in multiple places that the decision was made not on November 25th, but on November 30th. Mr. Schaefer's response to defendant's facts specifically admit decision was made on November 30th, not before, and specifically admit that the final deadline for the decision was the day after November 30th. Okay. Now, I think it's Judge Posner who had a great line on a case a number of years ago, which said that admissions trump evidence. Okay. When you have a party in the district court who admits to facts, okay, either by simply admitting or not responding one way or the other, okay, those admissions are deemed accepted, and it's inappropriate to then come up to this court and make new arguments that disagree with the facts admitted below.
Well, I think his position is consistent on what's in the emails of November 30th, and he specifically focuses on Lynch's statement that the team is already preparing for Bill's short-term leave in January, so his departure should not have any immediate negative impact. Why shouldn't we let the jury decide whether that was a reason for terminating Schaefer or an explanation of its effect? I mean, that's what we're really trying to decide here.
That statement is nowhere found in either the plaintiff's responses to that statement is in neither party's Rule 56 statement.
So you contest that Lynch even wrote that?
I'm not contesting it. I'm just saying he's waived his argument on it, okay? Because it's not in the Rule 56 statements, and he never raised it in his briefs below. He never argued that issue. His briefs below never argued that statement.
You know, when you turn away from the mic, it affects the ability to record that, and you're really speaking to us, not anyone else, please.
Neither his statement of facts in the district court nor his response to defendant's motion for summary judgment in the district court make the argument with reference to the effect of the decision. Okay? That statement is not there. Okay? So if it's not raised in the facts and it's not made in the argument, we maintain it can't now be resurrected in this court.
When was it disclosed that the statements or the computer-generated things were backdated?
Okay. Well, Your Honor, I have to object to the word backdated, okay, because that's counsel's
provided. Did not carry the date on which the decision was supposedly made then. however you want to characterize it.
Well, but see, the problem is they carried the date as of when they were told they should be. Daniel's statement, okay, it's uncontested, has the date on it, right, of November 21st, because that is the date of the notes, the underlying notes, which he transcribed. That's why they have that date. There's nothing backdated. It's ironic, and I give my colleague credit for using the term backdated because it's a provocative term, right? But if he would have dated it on the date he typed up the notes, we would have been accused of prospectively misdating it. Okay? There is no evidence to contradict Daniel's testimony that when I found out about the case, I typed up my notes, okay, and that's what they were. Okay? Uncontested. Okay? So the idea that it was backdated is simply, let's just call it a misnomer.
Well, if I understand it, he developed his notes on this particular date, and when he put them in printed form, he just used the date that was originally.
He transcribed the same date. Okay? I would venture to say that any person in this court has done handwritten notes and then transcribed them or had them transcribed and used the date that was in the original notes, not the date that they were transcribed. And so to call that backdating.
It is curious that he then shredded the underlying notes after he had been in consultation with counsel. That's very curious.
I cannot explain why his explanation was he had the actual notes that he had transcribed. Why save the draft? Mm-hmm. Right? Now,
that's kind of an unsatisfactory.
Well, from our perspective, ex post facto, looking back on it, you can say it raises a question. Right? But it's the testimony that's in the record is uncontested as to what those notes were. Right? And in particular, okay, those notes were dated November 21st, which, of course, is after, everybody agrees, Lynch, the decision maker, not Daniels, knew about Schaefer's request for leave. Okay. Now, plaintiff's counsel, Mr. Schaefer's counsel, argues, well, Mr. Daniels didn't really know when Schaefer requested leave, so he backdated it in the hopes that it would have been before Schaefer had requested leave. Right? No support for that.
And let me get back to this statement that I, my original question that dealt with the team is preparing this short-term business. You did include that email and presented it to the district court, and the district court considered it. You know, that language of the team is preparing for Bill's short-term leave. The full email was presented to the district court, and it was
the full email was attached as an exhibit, but that language was not put into the plaintiff's statement of additional facts.
Something that the district court considered. And so I guess I'm having some problems as to why we shouldn't consider
it. Well, I beg to differ, Your Honor. The district court decision specifically said, I am not considering any facts not in the Rule 56 statements. Okay? And she specifically referred to another statement in that same memo that was related to the age place that's not on appeal here. There was another statement that says something like, quote, it figures Mr. Schaefer is not involved in our future plans. Right? Mr. Schaefer tried to argue that was evidence of age discrimination. The court said, I am not considering it because it was not in the Rule 56 statement. Right? It's the same rule applies here, and this court has been rather strict on that. If you could just get around the Rule 56 requirements by attaching exhibits and transcripts, then it would eviscerate the rule. Right? The rule is very simple and very clear. If you want the district court to to address an alleged fact, it has to be in the Rule 56 statement. Not only wasn't that in the statement, it also wasn't even argued by the plaintiff. So we can certainly discuss it on the merits if the court wants, but I would argue that we're spinning our wheels because it's not properly before this court. But there are a number of other arguments that aren't properly before the court. It's the same sort of problem where they were arguments were not raised below. It has to do with the difference between raising a retaliation claim under the FMLA as opposed to an interference claim, the difference between raising a direct evidence case as opposed to a prima facie indirect evidence case. Without getting into all the details, suffice it to say, if you don't make an argument in the district court, you can't come up to this court and make that argument that you neglected to do below. Okay. There was some discussion during Mr. Schaefer's counsel's oral argument about differing explanations. Right? The district court found, and we would argue, that all of the explanations that were provided were consistent with the reason why Lynch decided to select Schaefer for the RIF rather than Friedman. Right? And that reason was that it would be in the best interest of his department and the least disruptive, right, to make the decision, to make the switch, his 11th hour switch, which he admits was painful. Right? Counsel says, well, nothing's happened in the interim. Well, in fact, between his original decision to select Friedman and his decision to later select Schaefer, several things happened in the interim. One, as you pointed out, was the interim meeting. Plaintiff's counsel says what happened at the interim meeting is hotly contested. That's simply false. Okay?
But he's told by Lynch that performance has nothing to do with his decision.
That's absolutely correct. And
so aren't you trying to build it in after he's told that?
No. First of all, okay, there is no obligation when you're firing somebody and you're selecting somebody for a RIF, okay, right, to lay out all the reasons that affected that. Mr. Schaefer was not terminated for poor performance. Okay? Mr. Schaefer was terminated, okay, because it was in the best interest of the department. The conclusion that Lynch got from the interim meeting was not that Mr. Schaefer screwed up. Right? It was that as a result of that incident, he could go in and do what he did, which is supervise the speechwriters and remove a layer of management. That's what he decided. It wasn't that he decided Mr. Schaefer screwed up and he needs to be fired. I mean, there's a fundamental difference there. The statement that performance was not a factor is a true statement, but that doesn't mean it didn't influence that the interim meeting didn't influence the decision. It certainly did, okay? And it certainly was the catalyst which enlightened Lynch on what decision he ought to make.
How much longer before Friedman was riffed?
May. So it was they kept Schaefer on the payroll through the end of the year because they were trying to get him covered, make sure he was going to be covered for his disability leave, which he was planning on taking I think it was January 4. So they would continue him up to there so he'd be covered. Then another 100 people were laid off in May, including Friedman. Well, I think the light just solved my problem. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. How much time?
I just have a very... First of all, Judge Sinder, with regard to the last
statement about Friedman being riffed in May, the court should be aware of it, and I think it's in the record, that between the time Mr. Schaefer was terminated and the riff, at least two of the other speech writers had left. And there is testimony in the record from Mr. Lynch that Schaefer would still have been employed as of the time of his deposition if he hadn't been riffed back in December. With regard to the waiver argument, I have a hard time understanding that. We attached that November 30th memo to the statement of additional facts, and I directed the district court's attention to it at page 4 and 5 of my memorandum in opposition to summary judgment to that specific sentence. I don't know what else I could have done to preserve that issue.
I was looking at her memorandum opinion, and she makes specific reference to that on page 7 when she says relevant facts.
And with regard to undisputed fact that the decision was made on November 30th, that was the decision to terminate Schaefer. We agree that the decision earlier was made October 28th, and that was the decision to terminate Mr. Friedman. So we're asking this court to let the jury make the determination. Perhaps they'll buy some of the innocent constructions that the defendant's putting forth about the backdated memos. We think there's a more nefarious a reason for them, but that's an inference that a jury should be allowed to draw, and they should make the determination of what motivated Mr. Lynch. We'd ask the court to reverse summary judgment and to reverse the finding with regard to the privilege of what's District Court Document Number 38. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.